You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you believe in UFOs? Swear your friend is a psychic? Would you like John Edwards to contact one of your relatives who has crossed over? You certainly would not be alone. Nearly a third of Americans believe in astrology, witches, ghosts, extraterrestrial contact. About half of us believe in ESP. Hillary Clinton has relied on psychic gurus, the Reagans on an astrologist. Jane Goodall believes in Bigfoot. Harvard professor John Mack supports alien abduction. Arthur C. Clarke believes cold fusion does work. And if you haven't checked your horoscope before, you might be out of the loop. Nearly every newspaper of the 800 in the United States runs them every day. Even new buildings going right up here in New York City are being built without a 13th floor. The snobs among us would say that only the uneducated believe in weird things, but that's not true. Highly educated people have their own beliefs. Perhaps they don't admit them as readily. Turns out more and more Americans are believing. In three Gallup polls taken over the past 30 years, the number of people that believe in things like ghosts and aliens visiting the Earth has been rising every decade. Many of these beliefs have little or no scientific evidence behind them, yet millions of us still believe. Why? And what's the real difference between science and pseudoscience anyway? Can't science tell us the truth about the existence of God, the devil? By the way, 41% of us believe in possession by the devil. That's what we'll be talking about this hour, and let me introduce my guest. Michael Shermer is a founding publisher of Skeptic magazine and director of the Skeptic Society. He writes the monthly Skeptic column for Scientific American, and he is the author of several books, including Why People Believe Weird Things, Pseudoscience, Superstition, and Other Confusions of Our Time, published by Owl Books. And he joins us from radio station KPCC in Pasadena. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Shermer.
Thanks, Ira. Good to be here.
Thank you. Stuart Weiss is the author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, published by Oxford University Press. He's also the chair of the psychology department at Connecticut College. He joins us from the campus in New London, Connecticut. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Weiss.
It's great to be here.
Michael, are you surprised by these statistics that I quoted?
Not really. I've been tracking this my whole adult life, and it is getting worse on a long-term time scale, I suppose. Over the last 500 years, we're not quite as superstitious as Europeans in the Middle Ages, but the paradox is that we live in the age of science. This is, 20th and 21st century now, and we have a strong secular education and science education and lots of diffusion to the public of scientific results, like on your own show. Why is it that more and more people are believing these things? So that's what we study, why people believe weird things, and especially considering the list of people you just rattled off there, Jane Goodall and Arthur C. Clarke. To me, the hard question is why smart people believe weird things.
And it is smart people who believe weird things, right?
It is, and the short answer is because smart people, intelligent people, educated people, whatever, are better at rationalizing beliefs they arrived at for non-smart reasons. That is to say, most of us, most of the time, have arrived at our beliefs for a whole variety of emotional, psychological reasons, how we were raised, who our parents were, our peer groups, our teachers, our education, our social background, where we were born, and so forth. These are the things that determine what we end up believing. And if you're smart and educated, you're really good at then using what we call the confirmation bias. That is, you look for confirmatory evidence for what you already believe, and you ignore disconfirmatory evidence. And the classic case of this is conspiracy thinking. Once you have a conspiracy theory that you think so-and-so is running the world, or this group is doing that, or Kennedy was assassinated, or by a conspiracy, or we never went to the moon, or whatever, it's easy to look around and find evidence that fits that belief and just ignore the stuff that doesn't.
So that would be a way of saying, I is taking your prejudice about belief in something and finding the evidence to fit that you like and putting out the evidence, pushing aside the evidence that
right.
doesn't work.
That's right. And in fact, the very popular science and religion debate these days is very much driven by that. I'm fond of saying that all these reasons to believe in God that are scientifically based, which are the ones that concern us at Skeptics, if you just believe based on faith or personal revelation, that's fine, that's your business. It's not our bailiwick here doing science. But if you claim you have scientific evidence, then that is our bailiwick. And so Usually what these reasons are, though, are reasons to believe if you already believe. So if you already believe in God and you're convinced that the whole thing, the universe is designed, it's easy to look around and see all the cosmological constants and the anthropic principle type arguments, and life sure looks designed because it is designed. But of course it's designed by a blind watchmaker, not a top-down designer. But for those who believe, then it's easy to find evidence to fit that.
Stuart Weiss, any comment?
I would agree with Michael entirely. I also think that what we should acknowledge is that we still live, despite the scientific age that we're in, we still live in an anxious environment, and there is a lot of anxiety, a feeling of lack of control, in fact, among many people, and superstitions and beliefs that confirm your own or evidence that you see that confirms your own belief system is very comforting. So there is, in fact, a psychological motivation in many cases to believe in these things because they give you a sense of control, even if it's an illusion.
What about the person who says, I'm an agnostic on certain things, but I don't want to discount them. Let's say UFOs, for example. I'm an agnostic on UFOs. Maybe they're there. I don't think science knows enough, or our research or our telescopes are good enough to find them yet, but they may be out there. So I want to keep an open mind about it.
I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, a number of scientists, have believed that it's likely that there is life somewhere out there, just in terms of the numbers and the possible environments that exist. I think that that's fine. But to say that the light I saw in the sky last night was a flying saucer is kind of a different thing. I think that the belief in actual flying saucers or UFOs is often maintained by not really thinking about the probabilities. I mean, what are the possible explanations for the thing I saw? And then once you recount what those things might be, some object that I couldn't see clearly, whatever, you have to think about, well, what's more likely? Is it more likely that it was, in fact, someone coming from a distant planet, or is it more likely that it was a natural explanation? And I think that's where the problem lies.
Michael Shermer, let me play a thought game with you, for example. Let's say I got a jury of a dozen people in a room, and I presented evidence for flying saucers, and people would give me testimony about it, and they would say, I saw this one, I've been abducted, or whatever. And you could line up thousands and thousands of people who were eyewitnesses to flying saucers. And I took the same jury, and instead of flying saucers, I put physicists who are talking about string theory. And then they would try to convince a jury that string theory is a valid idea and an argument, and they have absolutely no evidence to show them. Yet scientists will say that string theory is valid, even though they don't know what it is, they didn't see it, you can't touch it, you can't feel it, you can't prove it, you can't make an experiment. And yet they'll say, but these guys are crazy who think UFOs are real. Where is the science on one side and where is the superstition?
Well, because one's done at Caltech and the other one's done in Pucker Brush, Kansas, in the middle of nowhere. Well, look, let's face it. We can have more than two categories, either science or pseudoscience. I have at least one, what I call borderlands science, even wrote a book by that title, to try to say, look, let's have multiple fuzzy sets of categories of belief, of things that we're not quite sure about. So, for example, I wouldn't say string theory is proven, tested science. I would put it in this realm of borderlands science, that the mathematics is good. So I'm told. Hardly any of us actually understand the mathematics of string theory. And I'm told by my friends at Caltech, yeah, this is worth exploring, but this is still a far cry from, say, the empirical experimental evidence and support for, say, quantum mechanics. So it's different than UFOs also in the sense of the kind of evidence that's used. And I think it depends on the claim, to get back to your previous question there, of when is it legitimate to kind of keep an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. Where do you find that balance? And it depends on the claim. So, for example, things like UFOs and Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and so forth, those are fine to believe in based on anecdotes for a while. Anecdotal thinking is how we process information. Humans are pattern-seeking primates, and this is how we operate. But science needs more than that. So it's okay to say, you know, I saw something go bump in the night, I have these giant footprints, I saw this UFO or whatever, and then form a hypothesis and go, okay, there could be something here. Yeah, there could be. But in the case of UFOs and Bigfoot, we've had well over half a century of anecdotal claims. At some point, show me the body. I want to see the body, not a footprint, not anecdotes about things that go bump in the night, not a scrap of hair or a blurry photograph or a grainy video. At some point in science, you actually have to have a type specimen to name a new species.
Mm-hmm. So you have to.
So we have to have concrete evidence. So in the case of, like, say, multiple bubble universes, which is kind of one of our answers we have to intelligent design creationists who argue that, you know, how do you explain that the parameters of the universe are set up so nicely for life? Well, one answer is that, well, there might be multiple bubble universes in which they all have different parameters, and the ones that are like ours give rise to life. But, and they say, reasonably, prove it. Where's the evidence of these multiple bubble universes? Well, we don't have it, okay? But it's not junk science or pseudoscience. It's possible based on some reasonable hypothesis and mathematics, but we don't have the empirical evidence yet. So it's in the middle there between pseudoscience and science.
So science, to make something a question of science is different than a question of basically possibilities. Scientists have to have a theory to work on. They have to have some evidence. They have to have, this is what you'll find if you find it. This is a prediction we can make if you actually find something.
It's a combination of data and theory. You need both. One of the reasons that scientists, for example, do not accept psi or ESP or psychic power is not just because they haven't produced yet, the paranormalists, haven't produced replicable laboratory-controlled experiments. They have a couple, handful in the last century of statistically significant findings, but they've never been replicated in other labs, like with the cold fusion thing. We saw what happened with that. When it wasn't replicated, that was the end of that. The psi researchers have been unable to do that. But even if they could do that, even if they said, look, here we go, we've got what you guys have been asking for, controlled experiments, replicated in other labs, statistically significant, there'd still be the problem of explain the mechanism. How is it that my neurons firing in my skull somehow send a signal out into the ether and through your skull, Ira, and into your brain that causes your neurons to fire and pick up what I'm thinking? There's no known mechanism, and until that happens, it's going to be just like plate tectonics, like it was just continental drift. Until there was a mechanism, scientists did not accept that this process was going on.
If I can jump in.
Sure, go ahead.
I think that I would be satisfied, not satisfied, but I would say that some kind of, if the phenomenon can be demonstrated repeatedly in different environments, that would really be a big start. I agree with Michael, it would be nice to know what the mechanism behind it is. But I think there are many instances in which we observed a phenomenon that was reliable and weren't quite sure in the history of science. Michael, you're the historian, but what the mechanism was behind it, and later that mechanism was understood and supplied. So I'm willing even to go that far and say that it would be a big step forward if we could just see ESP as a reliable phenomenon, for example. It hasn't yet really happened, as Michael points out, But I think in a sense, if you want to have the paramount test, it is simply whether experiments can be conducted that are good and reliable and repeatable.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. We're talking about the paranormal, science, psychics, whatever, this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. One of the things you mentioned, Michael, is the need to have a reliable source, the person who is telling you this, to have a good track record of doing science and to come from a reliable laboratory. Yet in cold fusion, Pons and Fleischmann were very well-respected scientists, were they not?
Yeah, so science is a social process. And by the way, let me note parenthetically, congratulations on your terrific show Tuesday night on The Transistor, in which you definitely showed what a human social process it is and how personalities and egos definitely drive how science is done. And, in this case, I remember Feynman making a great comment about how science works, and it doesn't matter what your name is, it doesn't matter, you know, what institution you're at, or, you know, how profound you sound when you talk about your theory. It only matters what the evidence is. Well, he's right in the long run, but in the short run, it does matter who you are and who's doing the same. Science has to be a little elitist and somewhat conservative because there's so many crackpots out there with so many weird theories, most of which are wrong. that the big name scientists who are at the cutting edge, they just simply don't have the time to deal with a lot of these things. So my friends at Caltech, for example, they don't have the time to investigate every claim for perpetual motion machines and psychic powers, and what they get every week is these theories, what we call theories of everything, that Einstein was wrong and Newton was wrong and Hawking was wrong, but you know, I've worked out this new theory in my garage this weekend to show you that I've got this new theory of physics. These guys just don't have the time to deal with all that. So what looks to be, to an outsider, like elitism, and you guys have this peer review system and I can't break into it and science is not open to new ideas, this is not true. It just starts off temporarily as somewhat conservative, but if you actually in the long run have the evidence to support it, you will be heard ultimately.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if I can get a quick phone call before the break. Dan in Corvallis, Oregon. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hi, quickly.
I just wanted to know if skeptics should be skeptical of their skepticism.
I'm skeptical of that. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that makes you a skeptic. Of course, skepticism is not a position that you take. It's a process, a way of thinking. It is science. It's not that we don't believe anything. Skeptics believe all sorts of things. We believe the theory of evolution, for example. It's just that we don't believe things without some form of evidence. And so it's a process, a way of thinking.
Okay, then.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. 1-800-989-8255. Yet if you didn't have some of these nudniks, you know, like an Einstein, a Galileo, people like that who pushed their theories and kept banging on the doors to be heard, you might not have the advance of science.
Right. Yeah, that's right. We need those kinds of people. But the problem is that for every Galileo, Copernicus, Einstein who was right, there's 1,000 or 10,000 crackpots who were wrong. And so when the fringers say, well, you know, they laughed at the Wright brothers, and look what happened. I say, yeah, but they laughed at the Marx brothers. So what? Being laughed at doesn't make you right. You actually have to be right.
Dr. Stewart, fine.
Yes, I mean, I think we do need the sort of engine of new ideas all the time. We have to have that creativity. And so there will be these people who seem like they're out in left field, but if we didn't have that, then there wouldn't be any advance. But I agree with Michael that we also have to look at them pretty carefully, and the evidence. It basically comes down to what is the evidence, and I think you have to be careful. Michael is right that we sort of put more stock in what scientists say over other people. But I also like to hear what, you know, where they're getting their evidence. You know, there are plenty of examples of scientists who have signed on to various causes that are really outside their domain of expertise, and so they're using their authority to push an idea. So you have to be careful about whoever you're listening to.
Yeah, all right. Well, we're going to hear more of you, I hope, in the next, when we come back from this break. We have to take a short break, talking with Stuart Weiss, author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, and Michael Shermer, who writes the monthly Skeptic column for the Scientific American and author of Why People Believe Weird Things, Pseudoscience, Superstition, and Other Confusions of Our Time. So stay with us, unless you're too skeptical to come back. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan and guests on Monday in this hour for a Labor Day special, a look at workplace diversity and how it shapes the American dialogue on race. That's on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This hour, we're talking about science, pseudoscience, and why people believe in weird things with my guests, Michael Shermer, director of the Skeptic Society and author of the monthly Skeptics column for Scientific American magazine. He's also the author of Why People Believe Weird Things, Pseudoscience, Superstition, and Other Confusions of Our Time, published by Owl Books. Stuart Weiss is the author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, published by Oxford University Press. He's also the chair of the psychology department at Connecticut College. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You write, Michael, that 70% of Americans do not even know what the scientific method is. That's amazing.
Right. This is from an NSF study. The problem here is not just science education as in dissemination of facts. So, for example, knowing that the reason we have seasons is because of the tilt of the Earth's axis, not the distance from the sun, which apparently the majority of Harvard students don't even know that. But even knowing that, this study showed, is not a prophylactic against believing in paranormal beliefs and all those stats you started off this program with. Knowing the factoids of how the world works is different than knowing the scientific process, which is a method of asking questions and answering them about the world. And you need both. You need the facts, and you need the process. And so what we're trying to do at Skeptic is to talk about the process of science and the difference between science and pseudoscience. What is the difference? How do you know? What kinds of questions am I supposed to ask when I encounter a claim? Because I may not have the facts about Bigfoot or the evolution of primates and why there probably isn't a Bigfoot or whatever. Even if you don't know the facts, how can I think about, in a general process, that kind of claim? And that's what we're trying to do.
Stuart Weiss, tell us a little bit about what you call the psychological power of coincidence, because we see coincidences all the time and think, there's a connection.
Right. Well, we are very much looking for things that have meaning, and we are, of course, trying to succeed. In the case of a superstition, we're looking for something that will give us an edge, you know, on the golf course or wherever we're doing, even on an interview for a job. And so we often try to do whatever we can, especially in a situation where we don't have adequate control over the events in question. We don't know what's going to happen, to find something that will work. And suddenly you may notice, well, I've not worn this shirt before, and boy, that interview went really well. And somehow that gives you a sense of the importance of this thing. Other kinds of events that involve you, a coincidental meeting between two people, may have a very special sort of significance to you, in part because we tend to underestimate how likely those things really are. It's a common thing to teach in a class, this business of the birthday problem, where we try to determine whether anyone in the class has the same birthday. And it turns out that all you need is about 23 people in the room, and the chances of two people having the same birthday are over 50%. So in my classes, I'm able to usually find two or three matches often, and people are amazed by this. They don't realize that you know, each pair of people represents a whole nother set of possibilities. It's not just me and 365 days. And how could these 23 match me? It's also the next pair and the next and so on. And so the chances are quite a bit better than people think. We are looking for meaning. We're looking for something special that boosts our sense of importance. And these coincidences often do it.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phone. Let's go to Ann in Louisville. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
I'm pretty good. My experience was I went to a pet psychic who was recommended to me by several people. My dog had cancer. I was doing acupuncture and chemotherapy, and I was looking for an answer to whether he needed to be put down or not. So the psychic told me, he's been around mountains. Well, at the time, the majority of his life was spent in Florida, at Walt Disney World, so the only mountains he would have seen would have been Space Mountain, Thunder Mountain, and Splash Mountain.
That's great.
So much for predictions. I think we're looking for answers beyond science.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, we do things like this.
That's
right. Stuart Weiss, when people are told that somebody made it up, you know? Even when they're told, they don't stop believing, do they?
Right. No, it's true. I mean, there's a strong motivation. I mean, here we have someone with a pet that they undoubtedly, cared about, and it's the same, very similar to crossing over and so forth. There's a great urge to find another answer. Sometimes medicine in particular does not provide the answer that we are hoping for, and so we are looking for something else. And
well, in my case, the dog couldn't tell me he was hurting.
Right, that too.
You know, but it was time for me to go, you know?
That too. So there are, you know, but that's what we do, is we look for things that will fill in the gaps. And there is a limit to what we can understand, even with the best of science that we have available to us. And so if we can find some other explanation that works and gives us comfort in particular, that's a good thing, that at least that we're looking for. It may not be the right thing. I mean, it's not, I think most of us, Michael and I, would say it's better to believe in science and the rational than in magic, but it's certainly understandable in many circumstances that people do grasp for these things.
And thanks for calling. Good luck to you.
Have a great weekend.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Stan in Boise. Hi, Stan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thanks for taking my call. Hey, they had said that they needed rational scientific proof for the existence of God, and I think that NASA proved the existence of God back in the 50s or early 60s, whenever it was they were initially talking about the moonshot. My postulate is that since the Bible is the ultimate proof of God, if one part of the Bible is true, then basically all of it has to be true. And there was this, when they were trying to figure out exactly where the moon was in relationship to the Earth in order to make sure that they were going to actually hit the moon when they got there, they were lacking a day and a half. And there was the Christian man in the part of the NASA organization that said, you know what? The only thing I can think of is in the Bible. It talks about these two incidences where these battles going on. And the prophet said, what should God do to show faith to you? And in one instance, he made the sun stand still for a full 24 hours, and in another instance, he made it roll back. Now, we know that the sun doesn't move in relationship to the earth, but the earth moves in relationship to the sun, which means, in fact, the earth stood still. Gravity had no problems there with the earth standing still, obviously, because there was a whole day, which means God.
Okay,
had
stop right there. We tracked that story down for Skeptic. We ran an article on that. No,
well, what was the point?
Well, the point is that there's a missing NASA. The story is it's an urban legend. It's been passed around for 20 years now. The story is that a NASA scientist, through massive computers, discovered there's a day missing. Missing day is that is described in the Bible, mm-hmm. when you know the sun stopped in the sky for a day, that kind of thing. It's not true. It's no NASA scientist ever did this. There's no computer that computes all the way back thousands of years every single day and found one missing. It is pure urban legend. It's a myth. It never happened.
Well,
nobody at NASA or JPL computes what you just described. It never happened.
They didn't say it was a computer.
Well, there's different versions of the story. Some versions say it was a supercomputer. Another version says it was an actual scientist doing the computations. It's an urban legend. It never happened.
All right, Stan, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. A lot of urban myths. You know, there was that, speaking of the moon, there was the whole idea that we never went to the moon. That was a fabrication.
Oh, gosh, right. This Fox documentary, in quotes, that we never went to the moon. Yeah, I ended up writing a column on this for Scientific American. We did a whole piece in Junior Skeptic magazine on this, just because so many teachers had to deal with this because the kids saw this show. And they came to class the next day and said, hey, I saw this documentary on Fox. Oh, man. And so they had all these claims. You know, well, how come it is you don't see exhaust coming out of the rocket engine on the lunar lander when it takes off after they've been on the moon? And so we had to, you know, actually get answers to all these questions. Otherwise, why would you be worrying about such things? Because that's the power of the media. The power of television is that people see things in print, or they hear it on radio, or they see it on television, and they think there must be something to it. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why people believe weird things, is because the mass media.
Absolutely.
And there's so many shows now on about these things that they spread these things like urban legends, and they become real for a lot of people.
Well, the power of the media tells me I have to take a break and remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Maybe our next caller will have some suggestions. Eric from Sacramento. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Ira. Hey, Ira, can your guests, Michael and Stuart, recommend a website that teachers and professors can go to promote skepticism and critical thinking? And Ira, secondly, just to be a good skeptic, is there any evidence that teachers and professors can promote skepticism and critical thinking. I'll take my answer off here.
Okay, thank you. Let me just answer the last question. I've noticed from my experience that if someone believes something, it's very difficult to change their mind, no matter what the evidence you provide them.
That's true. Yeah. That's absolutely true. There are some studies that suggest that teaching critical thinking to students, college level and younger, can alter their beliefs some, but this is what we need to do, is to teach them sort of the methods of evidence and how to evaluate claims and so on. But so there is some evidence of that. But you're absolutely right. If you grow up believing that the 13th floor is unlucky, it's going to be hard to get rid of that belief in many cases.
Stuart, do you have a website you might suggest?
Well, I would suggest Michael's website. I think that the Skeptic Society has a very good one, and there is, Michael, you can say more about it.
It's www.skeptic.com, skeptic.com. We have on there, actually for $5, a baloney detection kit, which is a kit we designed, inspired by Carl Sagan's reference to baloney detection, a baloney detection kit for teachers on how to teach a course in critical thinking, science and pseudoscience, and all this stuff we've been talking about. How to use the paranormal and ESP, Bigfoot, UFOs, all this stuff, because it's so interesting to students. I mean, you'd have to be made out of wood not to be interested in this stuff. It is interesting, but how do we think about it? And so this little baloney detection kit, it basically provides different kinds of questions that you can show students how to ask about claims. It has reading lists. It has actual syllabi that teachers use. So it's for high school teachers and for college students. We also have Junior Skeptic Magazine for kids, inspired by Lisa Simpson, the great skeptic on The Simpsons. And so we also try to make science kind of fun, that it's, again, it's not a thing, it's a process. It's a way of thinking about the world, right? And what could be more exciting than science? Yeah.
What is the harm in believing in UFOs or ghosts or anything like that?
Well, that's a good question. In some cases, when it comes to a superstition that actually you're trying to use to perform better, not only may it not have a real harm to you personally, but it may actually help you. It may make you feel more in control, even though it's an illusion. But I think that, you know, there is a harm to society as a whole, and I'd like to hear what Michael says about this as well, but there's a harm to society as a whole in clinging to beliefs that are not validated, are not based on the kind of evidence that is repeatable and reliable. And we are not going to perform well as a society if large numbers of people believe in the paranormal, and as they do, in fact.
Yeah, that's right. It's what else it leads to as well. I mean, it seems relatively harmless for somebody to read an astrology column, but we know there's correlational studies, are in your book, Stuart, that people that believe in astrology also believe in a whole bunch of other claims like this. So our next issue of Skeptic that hits the newsstands next week, in fact, has this an answer to this question: what's the harm of talking to a psychic who talks to the dead? That is, why not go to John Edward and talk to your beloved mother? It makes me feel good. Why shouldn't I?
You'll have to go read it, because we're out of time.
Oh, we're out of time. Okay.
We're out of time. You have to go read that at his website. And we were talking with Michael Shermer, director of the Skeptic Society and author of Skeptic Column in Scientific American. He's also the author of Why People Believe Weird Things, Pseudoscience, Superstition, and Other Confusions of Our Time, published by Owl Books. Stuart Weiss, author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, published by Oxford University Press. He's also the chair of psychology department at Connecticut College. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this week.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galek and Paul Masiello in New York, and Doug Johnson in Pasadena. And, of course, you can always go to our website, and all these links we talked about on Science Friday, they're there. And you can find them and get also audio.com to download to your audio player, and also Real Audio on back issues of Science Friday. And also send us email at sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. Have a happy holiday. Safe Labor Day weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.